Your dreams are bigger, bolder, and more badass than the life you're living now, but something just keeps getting in the way. Join certified coach and former therapist Diane Wingert for the Driven Woman podcast. She'll show you how to get rid of whatever is holding you back so you can stop spinning your wheels and up-level your life. Get ready to hop in and buckle up. This is the Driven Woman podcast, and we're heading for the fast lane.
Well, welcome back, Driven Woman. You know how much I love sharing my biz besties with you, right? Well, today I am excited to introduce you to Annie P. Ruggles, fellow podcaster, non-sleazy sales consultant, and all-around genius for brains. We first hit it off online based on our mutual interest in the intersection of feminism, entrepreneurship, and mental health, and it has only gotten better from there. Annie is an absolute magician when it comes to helping female entrepreneurs, coaches, consultants, and service-based business owners be more successful by selling with integrity. Now, if you have ever struggled to ask for the business, ask for the money, send an invoice, or raise your prices, you are definitely going to want to listen to this episode with both ears wide open. Annie Ruggles, who is also called Anniepreneur, is an absolute open book when it comes to sharing all of her tricks, how it is to be an empath in the online world, the difficulty with being self-employed as a woman, and getting paid what we deserve. This episode is a bit more conversational because Annie and I have an ongoing friendship and even shared a room together at the recent She Podcast Live conference for female and non-binary podcasters. She is super smart and very generous with her expertise and her network. Annie Ruggles is truly one of the most original and brilliant people I know. Now, we are going to cover a lot of territory in this episode, so you are going to want to buckle up. But here are just a few of the mic drop moments you're going to want to listen for. Ready? Here we go. Over-delivering is not a victimless crime. Whew! Assholes don't get imposter syndrome. The difference between affordable and accessible. And we get all up into a juicy conversation about hashtag ambition shaming. I can't wait to share Annie with you. She is my buddy. She makes a fabulous guest. She has a fantastic podcast of her own. You got to check it out as soon as you're done listening to this. It is called Too Legitimate to Quit. And don't forget to head on over to the show notes and sign up for Annie's free sleaze-free selling mini masterclass. How's that for a no-brainer? Are you ready? Let's do this. Well, welcome back, Driven Woman. Today, you are in for a very special treat because even though I frequently do interviews, I don't usually have the opportunity to interview someone I know as well as today's guest, my good friend and colleague, Annie P. Ruggles. As a matter of fact, Annie and I have been loving each other up in the online space for a good little while now and actually got to hang out together and share a hotel room recently at the She Podcast Live conference. So that just took things to a whole other level. I have been a guest on her fabulous podcast, Too Legitimate to Quit. And finally, at long last, she is here today with me. We are going to get up into some very interesting things today, talking about the intersection of feminism, entrepreneurship, and mental health, and why women who have so much to offer have a hell of a time asking for money and demonstrating their value. So, Annie, it's happening. Here we are.
Hi, babe.
Hey.
It's happening. Woo-hoo. Well, first and foremost, I need your listeners to know that you are the kind of conference wife who made me crappy hotel coffee in bed. So I just want everyone to know that that's the kind of person you are. That's the kind of conference wife you are. You're very doting. You're very nurturing.
Thank you. Well, I have raised a couple of humans, so actually three, and I guess I still have some practice under my belt. So yeah, we had a fabulous time at She Podcast Live. And just, you know, to do some compliment slinging before we get into the meat and potatoes, you are a very generous human and have really helped me in so many ways to connect with other fabulous female entrepreneurs and podcasters. So I really have to thank you for that. In fact, some of the guests that are going to be coming up in the next few months are people that I wouldn't know if it weren't for you. All right. Where shall we start?
My currency is beautiful people.
See, you just have a way with words, girl. You have a way with words. Now, when I first met you, I was like, this girl has a way with words. And especially because calling your academy the non-sleazy sales academy for ask avoidant but money dependent do-gooders. I mean, that's a mouthful, but who doesn't identify with that? I know a lot of people in my audience identify with it, and everyone in your audience identifies with it. They are coaches. They are consultants, they are helpers, they are healers, they are service providers, but they also are people who are usually sensitive, creative, empathic, and often introverted. And that can be a powerful combination when it comes to delivering value and asking for the money, honey. Why do you think this group of people has so much trouble?
I see it as a form of preciousness. Right? Where those people you mentioned, the helpers, the healers, the coaches, I call those my proper noun people. And the reason I call them that is because they refer to their jobs as their calling or their purpose or their passion, capital P, right? And capital P and all of these different things. And that's, you know, what gets them out of the bed in the morning. That's their why. That's their Simon Sinek, all caps, why, right? And as such, it feels so much more part of us and so much more part of our legacy, our fate, our destiny than, you know, something like working in a typical office environment might foster, right? It feels more of us. And therefore, when it comes time to put that out there on a plate and ask people to pay for it or put that out there and even price it, it's hard to do because it feels like we're pricing our personality. Or for some people, especially for people that grew up in religious backgrounds, it feels like you're commoditizing a God-given gift.
I actually have heard that from quite a few people. In fact, some people that I have worked with as a coach who come from, you know, religious conservative families have said, I was always trained and indoctrinated to help other people because that was just an expectation of being a good person. So if I choose to withhold that, then I'm not being a good person. Sometimes it gets into some very interesting particulars, like almost like give till it hurts. Like if you see someone who needs something and you know what they need and you're in a position to help them, you should help them. It's like, but what if the thing that you have that could help that other person has monetary value and you need to get paid because you need to support yourself and your family, your pets? How do you overcome that difficulty? I think this can be a real psychological conundrum that makes people feel guilty, makes people feel ashamed, and they really have to incorporate this into their identity because lots of times it's very binary. Yep. Good people help, bad people don't. So if I choose to withhold any amount of help that I could give or ask for money when I could do it for free, that puts me in the bad person category.
Yep. But it's the same whole idea.
Have you had to overcome these things yourself?
Oh my God, 1,000,000,000%. I mean, here's the thing. I always say that client zero, patient zero of sales avoidance was me. 100%. 100%. 1,000 even, in that what I didn't realize is that over-delivering is not a victimless crime. The victim was me, and I have a high tolerance for pain, especially when I can justify it as being a good person.
That was priceless.
That's called martyrdom, folks.
Girl, that's a mic drop moment.
Yeah.
Over-delivering is not.
That's called martyrdom. It's
so
not.
Good.
It's not. And so when I looked at how much I was giving and I looked at how little I was receiving. What happened was that I was becoming resentful of the very people that I was so eager to help, because to my mind, I was giving and giving and giving and giving without any expectation of return. But when that return was never asked for, and therefore that return never came, part of me started going, well, what's in this for me? What's in this for me is nothing. What's in this for me is exhaustion, burnout, and table scraps. What's in this for me is overdrawn bank accounts and autoimmune disorders. What's in this for me is 18-hour days, right? And that was not because the client...
Eventually depression too, right?
Oh, hell yeah! And that's not because the client was taking advantage of me. If anything, they were taking advantage of me with my full permission. What I was doing in that moment was I was shutting down all avenues for me to give and receive simultaneously. I was all give and no receive. And what is the point of anything if you're unwilling to receive? What's the point?
This is tricky business, though, Annie, because you know, you think about how women are regarded in most cultures. Mm-hmm. We are rewarded. Yep. We are praised. We are held up as an example to other women when we are selfless, when we are generous, when mm-hmm. we are nurturing. Everyone talks about the woman who has a big heart. She would do anything for you. When adult children praise their mother publicly, they always say, she was always there for me. And so when that's held up mm-hmm. as the example of selflessness and putting other people first, it feels like an act of treason when we say,
oh, yeah,
I'm getting a little pissed. And I think I really appreciate that you're being honest about the fact that all the time that you were giving, that the resentment was coming from the fact that you actually did expect something in return. It just wasn't verbalized.
Yeah. And I just wouldn't admit it to myself. I wouldn't admit to myself that I wanted, because there's that idea again of, what does it mean to be a driven woman? What does it mean to be a woman who wants things? And so, you know, I'm just supposed to give and give and give and deliver and serve and serve and serve. And that's supposed to, what I'm supposed to receive in return is contentment or fulfillment or some idea of meaning, right? But honestly, what really started to turn it around for me is I started to look at the people that I loved to pay, even on a hard day, even when I couldn't afford it. I will give my veterinarian my last freaking dime when my dog eats a pot edible and needs to go to the freaking ER. Why? My vet is amazing. My vet is non-judgmental. My vet is not going to tell everyone in the world that I gave my dog drugs, because I didn't. She's just really rebellious in that way. Right.
Well, she knows where your stash is, bottom line.
But can I afford that vet bill? No. Oh, God, true. But like,
that's
why you
thing.
Don't name your dog after rock stars, everyone. Right. But like, do I, even though I can't afford that bill, and even though that bill comes on a day filled with stress and a lot of tears, I'm still so grateful that I have a veterinarian that I can pay to take care of my little furry family. Right. I know this last, you know, 18, 19 months of COVID have shown the whole world that educators are worth every single cent that they barely get paid, because the second adults had to watch their own kids all day, they were like, oh my God,
yeah.
Why aren't we paying these people more? Teachers are invaluable. Those teachers need to be better paid. Those parents now are looking at tuition bills going, yes, please, take my money. Same thing with daycare. You know, 2019, we're like, damn, daycare is expensive. 2021, we're like, hey, excuse me, could you extend your hours and take my kids? In fact, could you do summer camps, right? We're trying to find more ways to support the businesses that serve us. My question to myself became, why can't and why shouldn't I be someone that people are happy to pay or proud to pay? Why can't paying me feel good because it's fulfillment of a job well done? Why can't paying me feel good? And guess what? For a lot of people that were paying me, even though I was basically begging them not to pay me did feel good. So the only person in the situation that felt bad was me, the deliverer, the one doing all the work.
This is fascinating because I think
it doesn't work that way. It just doesn't. And I'm lucky I didn't drive myself out of business about 15 different ways.
I just think that it's so insightful. And because you're a super intuitive human, it makes so much sense that you figured it out this way. But recognizing that there was a disconnect between the fact that you weren't able to receive compensation for value, but you were more than happy to give, which you could say that's like related to the, oh, no, no, I'm fine. I just want to give. I don't need. But you were happy to pay others, even when you didn't have enough. And do you think that's something that, do you think everyone has that? Do you think every one of us has things that we are eager to pay for? Or do you think that some people would really love to be able to get everything they need for free? They don't actually like or enjoy or want to pay for things, even if they value them.
I feel like everybody has kryptonite when it comes to money.
I'd have to agree with that.
Right? Like even the most frugal people on the earth that have like, you know, the Bisquick tub with the cash in it in the cabinet for the rainy day fund. Like I think even those people will say, but I will never not serve the family on fine china. And if the china breaks, we got to go out and buy more. Like I'm pretty sure everybody has their kryptonite. So like, you know, a friend of mine who will never, ever, ever go out to a fancy meal. He's like George Costanza in this way. Mm-hmm. If you take him out to a restaurant and he thinks food is overpriced, he'll like grumpily order a side of fries and be like, can't believe they charge $6 for a side of fries. That guy, right?
Yeah.
That guy loves sneakers so much. He will spend more on one pair of shoes that he won't even wear because if you wear them, they get dirty. Mm-hmm. He would rather save up all of his money for shoes he doesn't even get to wear, but he will not order a side of vegetables with dinner because how dare they charge an extra $5 for broccoli? Hey, that's his prerogative. But when those new Air Jordans come out and he shells out hundreds of dollars, that gives him pleasure. The same way bitching about the $5 broccoli gives that person pleasure.
Okay, I'm making the connection here. It comes down to what you value. When we value something.
Yeah.
And I help people figure out what their core values are and then build their business around those values so that they don't end up hating their business. But when you really value something, it does give you pleasure to spend money on it. It's affirming, right? So, but I also think there's more to this mental fuckery when it comes to exchange of value, because something I see a lot in the coaching world is that people are indoctrinated, and frankly, many programs will train them that you need to first gain experience by working for free. Now, you know, I was a shrink for a lot of years before I became a coach myself, and that was it was part of your training. You did a lot of uncompensated labor while you're sort of earning your keep. This is true for apprenticeships and all kinds of things. But I noticed that a lot of people, once they are certified and legitimized in some way, licensed as a therapist, whatever it is, they still are in this habit of not charging. And so we call this barter or, you know, some other sorts of things. So I think, do you draw a distinction between people who feel okay about bartering versus not getting paid at all? Do you think there's a difference? Like some people will barter, but they have a hard time asking for money. Other people will ask for money, just not very much. And then some people are like, okay, I feel okay asking for this much, but they lose their minds when you tell them it's time to raise their prices. Do you think these are all separate issues or do they all come from the same root cause that we have a hard time receiving?
I think barter economy and gift economy are both really, really well-intentioned. But in order to work again, would have to be a global shift. And what I mean by that is, I think baby goats are adorable. Oh my goodness, they're so cute. They just hop around. They make their weird little noises. I wish I had a baby goat right now. But if a farmer came to me and said, Annie, I would like to trade you membership for the Non-Sleazy Sales Academy, and in exchange, I will give you my most prime baby goat, I will say, yay, based on novelty alone. And then the tax man will come and they will say, give us 10% of your goat. What am I supposed to do? How do I give someone 10% of a goat? How do I pay my mortgage in a goat? Right? And so the thing about barter is I will barter if the person on the other end has something that I genuinely want or need. And sometimes it is a want. Sometimes it's not a need. Perfect example. I have a dear friend and a client named Lowry Olofsson, nicest guy in the entire country of Canada. Lowry does this really amazing thing where he puts people's affirmations and desires to music, and he calls it a power song because he's a songwriter. I wanted one. Lowry wanted a new website. Guess what? That is a lovely little barter situation. I had the bandwidth. I had the time. I could excuse the money because he had something of equal value that I wanted. But if I did that too much, right? If someone offers me back on the daycare kick, if someone said, hey, Annie, can I have your program in exchange for daycare? Yeah, I don't have kids, but sure, I guess I could give it to my nephew. Okay, well, now my nephew is profiting from my labor and I'm not, and right? It's too hard to track. It's too hard to level. It's too hard to maintain, but it's based on this idea of we all have wonders to give. Yes, we do. But we don't all need each other's wonders in a perfectly portioned, equally timed way. Therefore, we should probably learn to accept some freaking money.
Yeah, agreed.
Because barter system would be epic, but everyone would have to start taking livestock and crafts. I mean, I would pay for everything in crafts. I'd be like, here you go. You got a candle and you got a salted
and you
soap.
Got a candle okay? And you
and then
got
you
a
go
candle.
And buy a sandwich. Right. And then you go to the corner store and you buy a loaf of bread with, you know, this wreath I made you. Like, what? Like, it would have to be so huge in order to do it right. It's much, much easier to make sure your pricing is accessible.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't have to be affordable. Does have to be accessible. It's much better for you to have a ladder of services so you can meet people where they are, or a variety of products so you can fill different needs. That is a lot easier than trying to come up with a ledger where you're getting people's info crack and livestock and crafts and well-intentioned words.
Okay, hold the phone. I want you to describe what you see as the difference between accessible and affordable. Because, you know, when I was still a therapist back in California, I had a client who, right in the middle of a session, said, Diane, I have worked with a lot of different therapists over the years. None of them come close to you. I said, why, thank you, Susan. Mm-hmm. That's a wonderful compliment. And she said, and you are charging way too little for your services. And I said, okay. Mm-hmm. She says, I'm giving you a raise. Now, this was back when, you know, I was seeing people face to face. I had an office. She was paying with a
okay.
check. I know. I was literally like, my brain started to seize and I'm like, what's happening? She said, I'm giving you a raise. And when she wrote her check for that session and for every session that followed, she gave me like a 30% raise. And I thought, why didn't I think of that? Then, you know,
because she was delighted to pay you.
I know, but of course, I understand why she gave me the raise, but it was that, why didn't I think of giving myself the raise is my point. Why didn't I recognize that I wasn't charged? Well, some people do. Some people by the name of Roger and Bill and Dave do. But most people like us yes. don't. And I don't, this is definitely not just a female problem. I think there are people of color and trans people and queer people and people of other marginalized communities who have learned for many generations that it is not safe to ask for anything, much less more of anything. And I don't want to invalidate that experience at all, but there are people who don't have any difficulty at all giving themselves a raise. In fact, I think you know in the online coaching world, there's this battle cry of double your rates going on. And people that don't do that feel like they're somehow screwing up. So it's kind of like, it's a very confusing thing. On the one hand, we're supposed to do everything for free.
And I am doing that and it's challenging. And I'm a pricing specialist and I'm doubling my rates and it's scary and it's hard. I got the same money baggage as anybody else. The difference is I understand that that's just money baggage and my own limitation getting in my own way. Every single advisor I have has told me those rates need to go up. I trust my team. At the end of the day, I have to go, okay, what am I going to listen to? Am I going to listen to the same stuff that has kept me small and almost put me out of business 100 billion times? Or am I going to listen to the people that I trust that know my business, that know my heart, that know my ethics, that know my integrity, that understand the kind of service I'm going to provide and say I can do more of it if I charge this rate? Yeah, I got to listen to them. I can't listen to me in that aspect. I listen to me all day, every day, but sometimes I'm wrong.
No. Okay. Okay. I got to reel us both in here. Affordable versus accessible on the one hand, and then double your rates on the other. And it's like, and I think this is, you know, we can get up into the weeds on asking for what we need, asking for more, recognizing that worth and value aren't the same. All we can talk about all those things. But at the end of the day, if we really want to serve people, we can't just keep doubling our rates because the number of people that we can serve in that way will be a shrinking pool at some point. But what is the difference between affordable and accessible? And where does the double your rates conversation come into that? Because I'm genuinely confused.
Affordable is a myth in that it's entirely relative. What's affordable to me today, what's affordable to me tomorrow may be different. And that's still me, right? We brought up the fact that my dog loves to eat everything earlier. So if you get me on a day where I have an emergency vet bill, something that I easily could have, should have, would have paid for yesterday is going to seem a little bit tougher today because I have an emergency vet bill, even if it is in essence affordable. That's just me to me relativity. Now let's look interpersonally. My budget and what I would spend on sales training is very low because I don't have a personal need for sales training. However, your budget for sales training could be higher because that's not your expertise. Similarly, I've paid really excellent money for therapy. You probably have somebody you could professionally trade with back in the day that you'd be like, let's honor each other's prices, but give each other an industry rate, right? The budget changes. And then we bring in my friend with the sneakers, won't pay for broccoli, will pay for sneakers, right? As such, he thinks broccoli, not affordable. Sneakers, worth the money, right? Affordability is all over the map. And when we start going, well, what's affordable here? Right now, people on the internet are charging more than you and killing it, and charging less than you and killing it.
True.
And right now, people across the world are spending more than your highest ticket offer on a purse, and good for them. That's their prerogative. It's their money. Do what you want, right? But if I try to come up with affordability, it's like trying to nail a fish to a wall. What's affordable for me is not what's affordable for you. But what I can do is price my stuff where it should be priced according to market research, competitive analysis, and what I'm actually providing. And what I can do is I can cut that up into itty bitty little payments and extend the value over time. So that
that's
if
accessible.
Everybody has to pay $2,000, some people can't pay. That's accessible. Not everybody can pay $2,000 in a lump sum. But if I say, hey, could you pay $20 for a billion years? Yeah, they could.
You're going to be fine. You know, I never really thought about Annie. I never thought about it that way because, you know, we all have like discovery calls and then someone will say, oh, that's more than I expected. I can't afford that. Right. Versus you don't have to change your price. You can change your model of how they pay you. if you require it in one lump sum, someone may say, I can't afford that. But if they pay the same amount of money over several months, it now becomes affordable. It's the same dollar value, but that's what makes it accessible. I never really thought about it that way. That's really helpful.
And even sometimes when it's not the same dollar value, there are still ways that you can make slight concessions that are better than discounting, because discounting is a big fat trap that says, hey, by the way, the price that I told you before, completely ignore everything I said about it. That's invalid. Let me get you the insider price, right? That's why I don't ever talk about discounting. But there is something to be said for, let me meet you where you are with what you can afford, or let me have a ladder of services so that if what I'm offering you is a 5-course meal and you can't afford the 5-course meal, or maybe don't even need the 5-course meal, well then, hey, let me get you the first course. Let's get you a small win. Let's go from A to B, right? And what were you planning on spending on this problem? Okay, I got $25. Cool. Well, for $25, I can either offer you the first installment on this long-term thing, or I can offer you this quick win, right? And it's all the exact same price point. Even if you have to wiggle a little bit, it's still better than discounting. So one thing that I do that everybody thinks is crazy, except for the people that benefit from it, including me, are I offer flat pricing. So for the Academy, it's 100 a month. That's 100 pounds, 100 Canadian, 100 US, 100 Australian. It can't be 100 rupees. I tried. That's weird. But people are like, well, wait, then you only get like $80 after the Canadian exchange rate. Well, yeah, but I would have at least spent $20 more trying to get that wonderful Canadian into my community when I could have just said, why do you always have to pay up the nose on exchange rate? Here, it's all the same to me. That's accessibility. That's accessibility over affordability. I understand that the exchange rate is tough on Canadians and Australians. I take that away. I take a small hit in exchange for that marketing.
You're eliminating a sales objection.
That's accessibility over affordability.
Well, you're also making it super simple and streamlined. I mean, and here's the thing, and we're getting up into sales tactics, which I love and I think are fascinating. And this is absolutely your wheelhouse. This is your wheelhouse. Look at how skillfully you steered this conversation to your area of expertise. That's why I love you. Whoops. Okay, why didn't you charge $97 a month like everybody else? Why 100? Hey, it's Diane. You know, it's almost the end of 2021. And if you are like so many entrepreneurs, just waiting for things to get better, I think you're in for a long wait. I don't think any of us expected the pandemic to be going on this long, and we are nowhere near the end of it. So if 2022 needs to be a lot better for you, and you just can't wait for that to automatically happen, the market is getting more crowded, the internet is becoming a noisier place, and if you are a female solopreneur with a service-based online business, I'm just going to guess that you would benefit from guidance, support, and accountability from a coach who knows the landscape. Now, I may not be your cup of tea, but if you like the Driven Woman podcast, I just might. So I'm making this quick announcement that I will be reducing the number of spots for one-on-one coaching clients in 2022 and raising my fees. I will be launching my membership program, so that's the more affordable option, but you do need to go through with a cohort so we can't focus exclusively on you and your business. If you are interested in working with me one-on-one, want to pay 2021 prices, but start in 2022, you need to connect with me now before the year is over. There's a link in the show notes, book a consult. I will have a few consultation spots available during the holidays. We can chat, make sure we're a good fit. You can pay the 2021 prices and start working with me after the new year, or you can wait. But is waiting doing you any good? I don't mean to be confrontational. I really don't. But I have waited for so many things and should have taken action. So now I try to help other women not do that. The world is moving forward whether we do or not. So I want to help you move forward. If you're down for that, let me know. Otherwise, thanks for listening to the podcast. We have much more juicy goodness in store for you in the new year. Just keep coming back every Tuesday. I'll be right here. If you want to know what one of my happy clients says about working with me, have a listen to this.
Well, one thing that you helped give me insight on is how sensitive I am. And because I'm an empath, being in traffic and loud noises throughout the day, just getting to home, that alone was really draining. And now working from home, it's like I'm able to conserve that energy. And working with the parents to really teach them kind of concepts and bigger things that have a bigger impact. Which is one thing that you also mentioned was because I was working so much, I didn't have time to do the things that were meaningful to me. And that included learning, getting into the grind. You kind of just like, okay, well, I'm just going to do instead of really stepping back and looking at more strategic ways to have, a longer term plan.
Because gimmicks are gimmicks, right? Now, here's the thing. All pricing science has value. And one of the things that they did, the reason why sevens and nines became prevalent was back when everything was in change. I don't want to spend a whole dollar. I want to spend 99 cents. If I say dollar, then that's a new echelon of pricing. If I say 99 cents, then I'm ending it with cents. So when I say that something is $9.97, I can either say it as 997, so the last thing you hear is seven, or I can say it's $997, and the thing that you hear is the hundred. Whereas if I say it's $1,000, the thing you hear is the thousand. That stuff is ingrained in us, right? Mm-hmm. But there's a pro and a con to thinking that way. Yes, $97 does for some weird reason seem considerably cheaper than $100. But the reason I don't do the 97 is if I say, hey, how many hours would it save you to do this work? Oh, probably three. Okay. How many hours go into $97 of your life? The math
I need a calculator. Yeah.
Right. But that $3 difference, they go, even if it's not how many hours, even if you are trying to do like a price replacement, right? Stop spending over here so you could invest more over here. That's very common in sales, right?
Yep.
But even so, how many $5 footlongs go into $100? It's easy, simple grade school math. It's not 4.8. I understand mentally, I have my own concept in my own budget of what $100 looks like. I don't have as clear a picture as immediately when it comes to 97.
Look how clever you are. And do you think that this, it's not a guesswork. You know that when people get confused over something like, well, how does this divide? They'll say no. Simply because no one wants to make a mistake. No one wants to feel stupid. No one wants to think they're being taken advantage of or manipulated. So if they can't do the simple math in their head, they'll say no to the offer without even understanding why. Right?
Yeah. We don't need to give people reasons to exit. And the number one way that we give people those exit routes is overcomplicating things.
We confuse them. I'm an expert at overcomplicating things, not because I try to be. It comes naturally. So I usually develop whatever it is, and then I need to go in and remove most of it so that it's not too complicated for me or for anyone else to understand.
I mean, I've said before, I would start Overcomplicators Anonymous, but I would overcomplicate the process of starting it.
Yeah.
Like I've said that so many times.
For sure.
I have, and the listeners don't know this because we haven't brought this up yet, but as a mental health professional in more than one way, I have obsessive compulsive disorder. Mm-hmm. So when I say I fixate on something, oh, Nelly, do I freaking fixate? And believe me, I've done all this stuff. The nines, the sevens, the 50s, the 37s, the should I send this email at 2 a.m. or 6 a.m. or 2 p.m, right? There's logic in all strategy. And some of it is going to be right for you and some of it is going to be wrong for you. But at the end of the day, I personally always err on the side of simplicity because I'm asking someone to take a leap, and the easier and cushier I can make that leap, the better, because they are overcoming inertia to click that buy button. Why would I then go, wait, why are they doing this weird shit with the sevens? Don't even put that out there, yo. Just say it's 100 flat in your choice of currency. Bam, done, accessible.
What do you think the biggest challenges are of the people that join your academy? Who are the coaches and consultants and helpers and healers and course creators and service providers who know that they could have a more viable, more successful, more profitable business if they could get better at asking to be paid and receiving and appropriately raising their rate? All the things that you deal with in the Non-Sleazy Sales Academy, what are like the top problems that people have that cause them to decide to join the academy? And are there typical ones that you see that most people have?
Yeah. Money baggage, like we talked about. Mm-hmm. But more than that, I call them the four forms of sales baggage. And the four forms of sales baggage, to take a large concept and put it in as few sentences as possible, and already they know I'm long-winded, so here we go, is really based on what the misconception is around what selling requires of you or who selling would require you to be. And that is a direct byproduct of little t sales trauma, right? I'm not talking big T sales trauma. Hopefully most of us have not been violently attacked by a salesperson, and there's our definition of sales. But at this point, if you've been on this planet for more than a minute, you've probably been sold to horribly more than once, more than 10 times, more than 100 times. And every time that happens, we have a little reporter notebook in our head that goes, selling requires arm twisting. Selling requires lying. Selling requires saying a deadline just to get the money and then disappearing. And we keep this running tally of what selling requires, but we don't put the people we previously talked about, the great veterinarians and daycare centers and fabulous chefs and Adele singing her head off, we don't put them on that same list. So what we have is a running tally of how not to sell. We don't have a guidebook on how to sell well. We only know, based on our own experience, how we don't want to be sold to. Then compound that with the fact that most of us learn how to sell as kids, being forced to sell door to door for our schools or churches, which is horrifying.
Our Girl Scouts.
And what do? We're terrible at it. Right. And we're terrible at it. We're all freaking terrible at it. And so as little kids, we're rocking around going, I hate this. I'm cold. My toes are frozen. I got snot on my mittens and I have to go door to door and sell this freaking wrapping paper that every other kid in my neighborhood is selling. I hate this. And then we grow up and we go, I would never sell. Remember this time when I had to sell Girl Scout cookies and that lady told me she was diabetic and I was trying to kill her? Right? Like that stuff. Then, and that is all if we have not ever been taught to sell. That's all what we inherit, kind of like what we absorb. But then when we look at the fact that, yes, a lot of sales is taught, gimme, 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 screw you, get me mine. When you look at those things, if you've been taught or instructed or forced to sell in that way, like in a corporate environment, you're going to go, look, I can't do this. And you're going to have a whole ledger of failure right there going, no, Annie, you can't. You can't. Guess what? That's sleaze. Guess what? That's nastiness. Guess what? That's greed. What that is not is sales. Sales is just asking for money in exchange for the problems you solve. That's freaking it. That's it. That's it. You're asking to be compensated for the problems that you solve. None of that other stuff is required behavior. As soon as we can unlearn that, then we look at the other patterns, the good patterns of the people that come to me. The sales baggage is the bad pattern. The good pattern is what we talked about at the very beginning. those proper nouns, the calling, the purpose, the passion, the genuine freaking love and care that these people show up for their clients, the tenacity, the sheer gorgeous ambition, the benevolence. Those things are hiding under a crust of not knowing how to send them out into the world fairly. And if we remove the crust, then we can look at empowering what unites them, which is that desire to give. But we got to move that. It's like when you wake up and you have sleep in your eyes. We got to move that old crap out of the way so that we could see clearly.
And you know what? I think your analogy about knowing that there are people who you love to pay and recognizing and choosing to believe that you could be that person for others. Yes. It's actually selfish to prevent them from paying you. I mean, I think about, you know, I think money is one thing, but it's not so different from compliments, praise. How many women do you know that when you try to give them a compliment, they're actively talking you out of it? And it's like, no, just stop.
Oh.
This is what you're supposed to do. When I say you did that well, I'm delighted with your work, whatever it is. And they're like, well, I really could have done. No, stop. Think all that if you must, but just stop. Just be present to the fact that I find value in what you've done. And just let that settle on you, because not even being able to take praise or positive regard for the work that you do. Yeah. No wonder you can't get paid. Because if you can't even get a compliment.
Absolutely. I mean, we've all had this experience too, overgivers. You have a friend who's going through something, or you have a friend who's going through something wonderful, and you're like, I am going to make this person a gift, or I am going to buy this person a really nice gift. And you pour yourself into it. You get that sucker engraved and you show up at their house and you present this gift, and you're not doing it so that they look at you and go, wow, Diane, this is the best gift in the world. But that is a little part of it. You've been so excited for that moment of joy that you cause. Guess what? You get there, and I hate public gift opening. That's not what I'm talking about, but maybe it's just the two of you. And you give the gift to the friend, and the friend goes, why did you buy me a gift? Now I have to buy you a gift. Why did you buy me this? I didn't ask you for this. What am I supposed to do with this? That hurts. And we've all been there. We've all been trying to give, and the other person doesn't want it for whatever reason. That's the exact same thing that happens when someone gives us a referral, a testimonial, or a compliment, and we go, no, stop, no. I'm rejecting your generosity. Knock it off. Knock it off. It's not attractive. And the other thing that you were talking about, it's totally true. It is hard and harmful to them if we refuse to serve them, because I ask the question all the time, and women especially find this so challenging. I say, what do you do better than anybody else in your industry? And they're like, oh, I don't know. Better is really, I mean,
that's so relative.
Okay. Then I started asking the question, right? And then I started asking, what do you do differently than anybody else? And even so, they'd go, well, you know, I follow. But then if I ask those exact same people, largely women, do you care about your customers more than your competitors do? They all say, oh, absolutely. And I say, is your industry good enough without you? And they say, absolutely not. And they say, would you trust your loved ones in the hands of your sleaziest competitor? And they say, no. And then I say, well, let's go back to the question one. What do you do better than anyone else? You love them more. So if you love them more, if you treat them better, if you see them more holistically, if you honor them, if you deliver for them, whatever you do, if any of that is more loving, more nurturing, more benevolent, more caring, then by not putting that out there in a viable, clickable way, you are saying, I don't care if you go to someone who will treat you less than me.
That probably blows a few minds in your academy.
Mm-hmm. And here's the thing, like you said, I don't say any of these kind of bitchy truth bombs with any judgment at all, because I was right there on the very front lines of over-delivering. I was right there until I got to the rock bottom of business and thought, I am the best kept secret in the world. I am incredible at what I do. I have carved out a legacy. I have escaped Cubicle Nation. I have done everything that I was supposed to do. And my quality of life is in the toilet. And I put it there. Why did I put it there? Because I wasn't willing to say, yes, I would love to help you. And in exchange, what I love is help in the form of compensation. That's it.
Just taking the drama out of it and saying it really is a math problem. It is an exchange of value.
Yeah.
I am providing a service which has value.
Yes.
You are paying me in dollars or, you know, whatever the currency is, which has value. It is an exchange mm-hmm. of value. We both have value. We exchange value. We feel valued. And the bottom line is we learned these dysfunctional negative ideas about worth and money and being paid and the value of our services and our gifts and all that. So we can unlearn those and we can learn new ones. I'm thinking about another interview that I did recently with a money mindset coach, and she was charging for her services what she thought she could get, and mm-hmm. accidentally found out that a gentleman who was doing exactly the same thing was charging considerably more. And it was literally like, I didn't know, her thought process went from, I didn't know that was possible to, but mm-hmm. is it possible for him, but not for me? And why would that? No, if it's possible for him, then it's equally possible for me. And now that I know that it is mm-hmm. an option, that's what I'm going to do. I think for other people, something we talked about a little bit before we started recording, Annie, was I think when we've gotten to the point where we recognize that what we do has value, we are willing to accept compensation for it. We have gotten to the point where we can ask to be paid and we're getting paid. Now we're talking about going to the next level of raising our prices or changing the mm-hmm. nature of our offers so that the dollar for hour, you know, ratio is different and we are now being compensated at a higher level. I find with some of my clients and also with myself, what enters into my thinking at that point is also affected by ambition shaming. And I'll tell you why. The idea that, okay, yes. I understand that what I do has value. I am happy to be paid for what I do. I recognize that I do it better than some people and differently than other people. And some people only want to get this service from me. But when it comes to going to the next level with your pricing structure, which will eliminate some people maybe, then it's like, well, don't you have enough? Why do you need more? Why isn't this enough? Why isn't this good enough for you? And I think that's kind of a subtle form of ambition shaming that sort of implies that you must be a greedy person to want more, which really casts shade on the fact that there are always going to be people who want more. Why is that a negative thing? Do you agree?
Well, and there's plenty for all of us. So why shouldn't we all want more? Right? I firmly believe that there's room at the top for all of us, right? There's 2.3 million podcasts. You've been on mine, I've been on yours. Neither of us went, wow, there's 2.3 million podcasts. We should just shut up.
Yeah, we shouldn't start one. There's plenty of podcasts already.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. And so that is us saying, right, but there could be more. There could be 2.3 million and one of them could be mine, right? There could be more here. And more is not just about money. If someone is unhappy in a relationship and they say, you know, I have a companion, but what I want is more. Okay. Well, some people will go, well, why don't you just, you know, stay home and shut up and try to fix the relationship you have? Well, if it's not fitting my needs, right? And there's other people out there. And so, you know, it's kind of like I think so much of it is we don't want to be the person who takes the most. And that is fine, right? One of my husband's habits that drives me insane is that he will go for seconds before everybody has had first. Oh my God, yes. But like in my family, in my super Italian family, I grew up, not saying this is right, women, but I think people will be able to relate. I watched my Italian aunts cook all day, and then they would trot all the men through the line to get their plates. And then they'd trot all the kids, and then the women who had kind of been picking at it, and then whoever the matriarch was ate last and got the scraps. And that is so fucked because she was the one who had been making those meatballs for three freaking days, right? So what drives me crazy, though, is that I thought there's nobility in that because there's love and service in that. That's how it was designed. I wait so you can have more. Right? My husband thinks more like my grandfather, who literally used to say, Father, Son, Holy Ghost, he who eats fastest gets the most, right? So my husband's from that school. If he's hungry and his plate's empty and there's still food left, he will go get more, whether or not he believes everyone has had their fair fill. That makes me insane because I don't want to be the person that is perceived as having the most. However, having the least, again, goes into that martyrdom place. We're not saying you have to have the most imaginable. We're not saying you have to stop being grateful for every single thing that you have in order to turn your back on all of it. We're just saying, if you're still hungry, babe, keep eating and don't put yourself last in line. If you spent all day or all weekend whipping up your special sauce for your entire family, then maybe before you let the family come into the kitchen, you should tuck your own plate into the oven. Nobody's going to judge you for that.
And if they do, they've just been subjected to the same fucked up indoctrination and are just unconsciously following it. I mean, the bottom line is there's a...
Yeah, but I think that it is, we don't want to be...
We don't want to have the most.
Go ahead.
Well, I'm thinking that there's a whole lot of room, Annie, between being a martyr and being a greedy bitch. And it almost feels like...
Oh, my God!
But it almost feels like we're treating this, and I kind of want to wrap up with this. I'm thinking that there's a lot of points on the spectrum, on the continuum between a selfless martyr and a greedy bitch. But it's almost like, even though we don't really like how it feels to get nothing and to watch everybody else get what they do, even if we have some sense of pride in that because of our programming, but it's like, if I want more than I have, then I am automatically hopping all the way over to the other end of the spectrum, and I am a greedy bitch. I'm like, that's a big leap. And it's not a binary thing. It's not you're either a selfless martyr or you're a greedy bitch. I'm like, there's a lot of points on the continuum, and you can stop wherever you want. If you start at a place where you're feeling resentful and exhausted and overwhelmed, okay, then that's obviously not working. Take another step to the right. How does that feel? Is that good enough? Not quite. Doesn't really notice a difference. Still feeling pretty resentful. Take another one. Like, there's a long way to go before you are all the way.
That is a long runway. Long runway.
But I'm almost thinking that's kind of the way we need to do it, because it's like, I think a lot of women feel like, unless I'm selfless, then I'm a greedy bitch. I'm like, no, this is not an on-off switch. It's a dimmer switch. You can dial up and dial down. What would it feel like to dial up just a little bit more and then a little bit more? At some point, you're going to feel like, I am being well compensated. I feel respected. My needs are being met. I feel like my income and my profitability and my pricing is appropriate to my skill and experience and what the market charges. and this feels good to me. Mm-hmm. This feels right to me. You don't have to keep going and going and going to, for what reason? Like,
nope.
But it's not either or.
No. One of my very favorite things to say, and I'm going to modify it here for the very first time, but one of my very favorite things to say always is that assholes don't get imposter syndrome. Right? If you're sitting there going, oh my God, who am I to be doing this work? Am I going to look like an asshole? You probably don't have asshole in you. If you are sitting there going, oh my God, I don't want to come off as a greedy bitch. Oh my God, I don't want to seem too greedy or too ambitious. You probably don't have enough greed in you for your ambition to go sour. Only lovely, wonderful, giving people worry about coming off as a greedy bitch. Greedy bitches are too focused on their own to even consider that they might be putting other people down. If you're wondering if you're a greedy bitch,
you're not.
You're not. If you're hungry, go make another plate. Come on.
I have the same message. I have the same message with my clients. It's like, you know, people who worry about whether they're taking advantage of others are not taking advantage of others, because people who actually take advantage of others are never worried about whether they are. It's a good litmus test. It is a good list. So you and I could just love on each other and chat about all this forever and ever and ever. But I want to respect the attention spans of other people who are not part of this conversation. Please tell everybody how they can find you. And I mean, they definitely have to follow your podcast, which is very unique and quite fascinating, Too Legitimate to Quit. And where do you want people to follow you? And what do you want them to know?
Go back to the very beginning of when Too Legitimate to Quit began, episode one. With this vision, this goddess, this powerhouse, Diane here.
I was the first guest.
We talk about Ren and Stimpy. We sing Log. That is a really, really great way to get me and brilliant people like Diane into your ears all the time. If you are in active sales avoidance, do not go to my website. Just message me. I'm a super accessible person. It's important to me. We talked about accessibility in this intro or in this episode. Reach out to me. I'm on LinkedIn under my name. I'm on Instagram under Anniepreneur. I'd love to hear from you. If you let me know what you're up against in terms of selling, maybe I can make things better for you right then and there so I can show you how lovely selling can be. Or if you just want to hang out, or if you're having a bad day because entrepreneurship's freaking hard and you need someone to send you a GIF, just reach out to me.
She has the best gifts ever. I can definitely attest to that. Okay, love, I think we're going to call this a wrap. Thank you for being here with me and with us and for helping us make some sense out of all this nonsense around sales and asking and receiving and ambition and all those things. We are definitely going to do this again. Promise?
Oh, of course. Thanks for having me and thanks for loving me.
Of course. Bye.
You've been listening to the Driven Woman Podcast with Diane Wingert. Want more straight talk and strategy each week that will take you from spinning to winning? Don't forget to hit subscribe in your podcast player so you won't miss a single episode. Then head on over to the Driven Woman free and private Facebook group community. See you there.